Okay, so I'll be talking about 1 over F noise in Josephson junctions. This is a list of my collaborators. Michael Mook is a person I worked with as a postdoc in John Clark's group, and I'm still collaborating with John Clark, who's at Berkeley. These are the supporters of the financial supporters, so it's ANSERC, CFI, OIT, the Research Corporation, and also Michael Lazaridis. This is my group. Chas Mugford is the person grad student working on the 1 over F noise measurements that I'll be talking about today. Xu Chao Meng is working on SQUID and hybrid with an SET. And this is a dilution refrigerator based experiment which requires a lot of filtering, which is very important for the later part of the work that I'm going to be talking about to get the proper temperature dependence of the 1 over F noise. Lauren Latris is working on transition head sensors. I won't talk about that, but anybody who wants to talk about that later in this meeting, I'd be very happy to discuss this stuff. And Jeff Quilliam, he works on holmium yttrium lithium fluoride. We're using a SQUID cetometer, and we're doing specific heat measurements on this frustrated magnetic material. Jeff Mason was working on SQUID NMR. He graduated with a master's, and I've got a new Jeff working on SQUID NMR. We've got a lot of Jeffs in this group, and his middle name is actually Jeff. So I don't know what's the deal with Jeff, but popular with squids, I guess. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do some kind of general introduction to Josephson junctions and 1 over F noise, a little bit touching on qubits, and then I'll talk about the measurements that we've been doing. Okay, so for Josephson junctions, basically that's superconducting an insulator, superconductor. You've got an order parameter on either side. The oxide barrier here, the thickness of that will decouple the phases of that order parameter. And what Josephson found in 1962, got the Nobel Prize for, is that there's this Josephson energy that's related to the phase difference in those superconductors as minus Ej cosine delta. Ej is inversely proportional to the normal state tunneling resistance of that oxide barrier. Okay, it's also proportional to the critical current due to that oxide barrier. Okay, the other thing that Josephson came up with is this voltage relation and the current relation, where it relates the voltage and the current of the junction to the phase difference. Okay, and so the voltage is proportional to the time derivative of the phase difference, and the current running through the junction is related to the sine of the phase difference. Okay. Okay, so this is a basic simple model for understanding how Josephson junction works and how SQUID works, and then how a lot of the qubits, superconducting qubits, work. So what you do is you take the Josephson relations, this voltage one and the current one. You can just take a Josephson junction, that's that symbol there, and then a capacitor and a resistor, put them in parallel, and use Kirchhoff's law. You get this differential equation over here. You sub in, instead of V, you sub in the equation for the delta there for the phase difference, and you get this second order differential equation. Now, this differential equation here ends up being analogous to a particle sitting on a washboard. In this analogy, which is very powerful for understanding these superconducting devices, the current running through the junction is related to the tilt of that washboard. The velocity of the particle is the voltage. The position of the particle is the phase difference across a junction, and one period is equal to a single flux quantum, or change in phase. Okay, so in this model, we have an R and a C, and what happens is you see the C acts like an effective mass, and R is a viscous drag force. Okay, so the lower the R is, the more viscous drag force you have. Okay, so what I'd like to just show is how we use this RCSJ model to understand how a SQUID or a Josephson junction would work. Okay, so the idea is we have this tilted washboard, and the tilt is related to the current that we're applying. So if we're applying a low current through the junction, then it's going to be horizontal and the phase particle is going to be trapped, and so then its velocity is going to be zero, and so you have zero voltage. And so if you were measuring the current versus the voltage, what you would see is zero voltage. And as I tilt the washboard, which means I'm raising the current running through this, okay, what's going to happen is I'm going to be raising the current, but because the phase particle is trapped, it's never going to start rolling, and so it has a zero velocity, so it has zero voltage across it. And then what happens is eventually you tilt it enough that the phase particle isn't trapped anymore and it can start rolling. And once it's rolling, it'll just keep speeding up and speeding up, which means its voltage increases, and it'll just go to the point where you're breaking pairs of the Josephson junction. There'll be a little bit of dissipation there. For that velocity, you'll be breaking the pairs, and it'll go and start acting like a normal conductor. Okay. Now, if you started bringing the current down again, you would have to go down to below this current, which is IC, and maybe if there's no dissipation, or if there's some intermediate level of dissipation, it'll snap out like that. And so this is a hysteretic junction. Okay. Now, if we have a lot of dissipation, then what will happen is the phase particle will have a terminal velocity that's going to be determined off of the level of dissipation, so the amount of the resistor across the junction, and also the tilt. And so then what happens is the IV characteristic would look something like this. And now, instead of just snapping and having this thing take off, you'll have some kind of a finite voltage that depends on how much current you're putting across it. And then it won't be hysteretic. Okay? Now, to run a squid, to make a nice function for a squid where the voltage ends up being a function of the flux running through it, you need to have this non-hysteretic parameter. So you need to have enough dissipation, and so you want to run on this function like that. Okay? Okay, so this slide over here. The idea, though, so I'm not showing the resistors. Most often people don't put the resistors across the junction, but basically there's a resistor there that's necessary to make a non-hysteretic junction. And that resistor creates noise. That noise, and it also creates dissipation, which spoils the operation of qubits. So then the challenge for qubits is to come up with superconducting devices that can take advantage of this interesting washboard potential picture with this kind of quantum particle here that we can have a tunnel from well to well. We can make circuits with different kinds of Josephson junctions to make different kinds of well structures. But the key is we don't want those resistors there to create dissipation. And so we are forced to work not with this non-hysteretic type of IV curve, but with this type of hysteretic system. Okay, so this is two junctions in parallel. That creates a DC squid. The amount of flux running through this loop ends up creating a screening current, and that screening current changes the IV characteristic. And effectively what it does is if there's if you change the magnetic field, the current flows through in here, it'll add to one of the junctions' current and reduce the current to the other junction sees, and it'll effectively just change the IV curve of that device and makes it look as if the critical current has gone down. Okay? So this is a current versus voltage for different amounts of flux. And if I go and sweep the magnetic field, I'll find that if I bias it at this point here with a DC current, that's why it's called a DC squid, if I apply DC current here, I'll have a modulation of the voltage that looks kind of sinusoidal, okay, as a function of the flux applied. Okay, so that's how a DC squid works. Now the thing is the noise of this is going to be due to the Nyquist noise, the thermal noise from the resistors across the junction. And so then to run a squid, what we do is often we'll optimize the system where we tune the flux with an external feedback coil to sit right on an optimal slope here where there's a very sensitive change in voltage for a given change in flux. Okay, and so then we're not exactly certain what that slope is. It might change with temperature or with the squid you're using. So what you do is you use a feedback loop. Basically, just to keep yourself in that spot, you kind of use null detection and you set up you apply a field that's equal and opposite to the one that your signal of interest is applying. So this might be a current that you want to measure. It goes through this coil, that'll be the input coil, and then we have a feedback coil that will create equal and opposite field to that to keep the field here, the total field here, constant. Okay, and so then we become independent of the exact slope here, and all we want to do is use it as a sensor. Okay. Okay. And so then here, this is a picture of a DC squid. We've got this is the loop, and instead of always in the pictures we put one junction on either side, but it's actually a lot easier to put all the sensitive alignment stuff in one end and put the junctions in one end here. And so this is a zoom of that, and you can see one junction and another. This is a niobium, and then there's aluminum, because aluminum oxidizes nicely. So it's a niobium, and then aluminum, it's oxidized, and then another layer of niobium is deposited on top. To create the small junction area, we have two windows of insulator to create a tunnel junction right in that cross intersection right there. And Michael Mook made these squids. And these are also the junctions that we're going to be studying, the 1 over F noise of. Okay. Right. The tunnel resistance is very large, and especially, all the quasi-particles are, they're basically, it's all Cooper pairs, and so the dissipative part is going to be very, very small. And so what we have to do, the resistance is large, the dissipation is very small, because the junction, because it's rolling down that washboard, acts like a voltage source, so the dissipation goes as V squared over R. What happens is that's the shunt resistor. Thanks. We deposit a palladium shunt resistor across here, and that's what's needed to make it non-hysteretic. Okay, and so then for qubits, it's going to be very quick, but basically there's three different kinds of qubits, and you can already tell in this meeting that there's definitely people who have patriotism to the different types of qubits, and I'm lucky, I'm working on 1 over F noise, and they all use junctions. They are all going to be dependent on 1 over F noise, so it doesn't matter to me. Some are more sensitive to 1 over F noise than others. This is a nice qubit because it's very pretty. And it's basically, you can see three junctions in a loop. What happens is this is the one that's being used to create the potential wells to make it act as a qubit. And then this is a DC squid with two junctions on either side. But now what's happened is to make that measurement of what state, what flux is running within this loop here, whether it's going up or down, you can't put resistors across here and just use it as a DC squid, or what would happen is the Nyquist noise, the thermal noise from those resistors, would create currents through here that would just destroy the coherence of that qubit state. So what has to be done instead is you have this thing, you load it, you have it time evolve, and then you check to see which direction the field is pointing by ramping up the current in here and seeing at what point does the critical current, at what point does the junction snap. And then you very accurately measure that critical current, and then you can figure out whether that was in the up state or the down state, and you do this over and over again many times, and you get a probability after, you know, loading it, having a time evolve, find out what time you ramp the current, and you find out what state it was in at that point, and then you can get this nice oscillation. That oscillation might be nanoseconds or microseconds, but the measurement can take a long time. And so what happens is 1 over F noise is that the a low frequency noise in these junctions, and so this device is actually changing in time while the measurement's being made. Okay, and so the sources of decoherence are external flux, Nyquist noise, currents from nearby metals, so just magnetic fields coming from those metals, noise from the measurement electronics, back action from the amplifiers. You can have motion of trapped charges. The charge qubits are very sensitive to that one, especially. And then also there's the 1 over F flicker noise in the critical current of the Josephson junction, which is what I'll be talking about. What we're going to talk about is measuring that 1 over F noise accurately. We're going to try to measure in a different mode where we're in a zero voltage state. It's always been done before with a shunt resistor, and so we're going to set up a measurement where we can measure the 1 over F noise without a shunt resistor, so without dissipation and without having it run in a voltage state. One of the things that happens when you're in a voltage state is that phase particles rolling down this washboard at a certain velocity, you get a Josephson frequency there, which could couple to other parts of your system and maybe it'll couple to fluctuators and activate a 1/f noise. So the idea was to try to set up a measurement where we're not in that state. Okay, but the big goal is to try to understand 1/f noise, try to lower the 1/f noise to make better qubits. Okay, so what's the origin of the 1/f noise? Well, a general principle is 1/f noise is basically it's due to or can be due to a distribution of fluctuators. If you have a single random telegraph signal, okay, you do a Fourier transform of it, it's going to have a power spectrum that looks like this, okay, and that's not 1/f at all. It goes as 1/f² at the higher frequency, and then it flattens out. But the idea is that in a material, you can have a distribution of fluctuators, a very large distribution of fluctuators, and there can be a higher probability of having slow fluctuators than fast fluctuators. And then a combination of these will add together to create something that looks like it's 1/f. And that's what, it doesn't take too many of these fluctuators at different frequencies to give a 1/f spectrum. Now what happens is if this is 1/f, it takes less energy or to activate these fluctuators, and so than these over here. So as you cool the system, you can imagine that you're going to, if you have a 1/f spectrum, that you're going to start freezing out fluctuators, and the amplitude of this 1/f will go down. Okay, so you expect to have a 1/f noise, which the spectral density should be proportional to the temperature. And this Dutta Horn has a very nice paper on this that was written in 81. Here's some data that we took. This is a time trace of a Josephson junction. We're measuring the critical current as a function of time, and it's changing by about, you know, some fractions of a nanoamp here. And what we can do is we can actually track the, this is a telegraph noise. And we took a lot of data on this, and then Fourier transform it, and you can see that you have this Lorentzian distribution. And this corresponds for a junction with a critical current of 2.5 microamps to a change in the critical current of 0.65 nanoamps. Okay, so that means if the critical current is fluctuating, then in this RCSJ model, what's happening is this washboard, the depth of that ripple is fluctuating. And then that's going to mean you're going to end up having a change in the frequency of your oscillations in your qubit. Well, there's a single fluctuator, but and that could be a large fluctuator, which would be great. But then, and we were very happy to see this. This is not like, it is nice data. And but there can also be 1/f underneath that. And so maybe there's different kinds of fluctuators. And so this has a critical current of 0.65 nanoamps. It corresponds to a trap, well, I'll talk about later, basically having an area of 5.6 nanometers. And so this might be a very big fluctuator. For instance, it could be a magnetic flux jumping around. And then there could be also charge fluctuators and a whole different kind of family of fluctuators. So that's
and is this something where, like, just one day you have to notice, like, oh, this junction has a single fluctuator, and then you get this data, or is this something that you
filter? Yeah, we make several of these, and they have different types of noise. Some junctions have less fluctuators than others. That's definitely true. Why? What are you seeing here? As the square root? Yeah, that happens. What's that? What, this here? That's a good point. That could be another fluctuator, and people can get very excited about that. But I think one of the things that... but the thing is that can also be, and you have to be very careful in the literature, in a way this Fourier transform works on a spectrum analyzer, I don't know how it exactly works, but I always throw out the first few points. There's some kind of boundary condition. It's very susceptible to some kind of a glitch, and it'll go up or down. And so I usually throw those away. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's exactly where you like it, but sometimes it's up. And, Okay, so the mechanism for 1/f noise is that this is a superconductor, and the model is that there's a trap. Some kind of a defect inside that oxide barrier, and a charge can jump in there and create a repulsion to eliminate that portion of the area of the junction from tunneling. Okay, so the effectively the barrier of the tunnel junction will fluctuate, and so the critical current of the device will fluctuate. Depending on whether the trap is filled or not filled, the critical current is going to go up or down. Okay, and then that changes the height of the washboard. And so, that's the model here. And the idea is that a single trap there will just change the effective area of that junction, and the critical current is just proportional to the change in area over the total area times the critical current. So if we have a very, very small junction, which some qubits require, then a single, if a trap has a certain minimum or standard diameter, then a small junction might have very few traps. But the one trap that's going to be filling and unfilling could have a very significant change in its critical current. Okay? Big junctions will have less of an effect from a fluctuator, but then what will happen is you have a lot more of them. And so it's like, for instance, Martinez has a qubit which he pushes to have very large junctions, and this will reduce the critical current fluctuation noise. But the problem is you have a lot more fluctuators then, which you can then activate with, for instance, those high frequency signals that he works at. So he puts in a 10 gigahertz signal to make the qubit run, and he can accidentally activate a fluctuator that was sitting dormant and frozen at the temperatures that he was working at, and then it'll end up creating an absorption. What's that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right, so that would be, we would think it's thermal activation, but then I would say that I take that same, I've seen fluctuators where I've cooled them, and the fluctuator doesn't change, and so it's temperature independent. Maybe at the temperatures that we're working at, we're not seeing any change. I'm not sure. No. It's the idea is that you have some kind of a defect there that might have an affinity to absorb some charge, and then unfill. That's the model. This is a model. The thing to do is, I'll have a reference, but a nice paper that a lot of this is talked about is Dale Van Harlingen has a paper, and you can read that and go from there, I think. Okay, but
I can just describe everything by means of gathering magic, mm-hmm. which would include all the detectors, traps, and so on, mm-hmm. and calculate at least theoretically the physical current, and it wouldn't fluctuate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might be complicated. It might be reduced as compared to the case where you have no traps.
Mm-hmm. I think there isn't enough information, I think, right now. Okay, so basically the Van Harlingen paper is here. You can take a look at it. But basically he calculated how the different kinds of qubits of the day would be affected by a 1 over F noise that would be typical of the junctions. Basically certain kinds of junctions will have more of a sensitivity to this type of fluctuation. And basically he says that there some junctions are much closer to the limit so they're almost limited by 1 over F noise, and some are far away from that. Okay, so let me go to one of our F noise measurements that have been done in the past. And so you can see Roger over here, and John Clark has focused a lot of time on this one over F noise problem in the past, in the 80s. And Fred Wellstead, in his PhD thesis, measured the temperature dependence of the 1 over F noise of 6 different junctions and found instead of a T dependence, which would be this thermally activated fluctuators freezing out, the Dutta Horn would have predicted a T dependence. They measure a T squared dependence. Maybe it's freezing out at lowest temperatures, but basically that's what they see. Now this is the 1 over F noise in squids, and a squid can be sensitive to flux hopping also, not just charges hopping. And so that's not clear whether that would be from just charge hopping or not. And but that's the measurement in this temperature dependence. Okay. And this is their power spectrums. And this is recent work by Dale Van Harlingen's group. This is Travis Crane. He did his PhD. You can find it on the web. I guess it's unpublished other than being in the thesis, but they've got some results here for some very large critical current junctions. This is 85 microamps. This one has 25 microamps. They're measuring the temperature dependence. So the question is the temperature dependence really T squared? Does it reach some kind of a limit which becomes temperature independent and is just due to quantum fluctuations or what? So they end up measuring T squared dependence. T squared dependence for high temperature, and then it flattens out at around 1 Kelvin. And they're saying that that's probably not due to self-heating, because it is such a high temperature, it would be very surprising to have self-heating by that temperature. And so this would be maybe due to quantum mechanics. Okay, so the idea is to try to also come up with a way of understanding the quality of junctions to see whether how do we characterize them and see if we can lower the 1 over F noise of junctions. And the idea is that the spectral density is going to be related to the critical current. And so if you want to compare one junction and another, you for let's say a certain type of process, you want to be able to compare different junctions with different critical currents, come up with some kind of an invariant parameter. And so that's what in Devin Harlingen's paper he discusses, and he comes up with this model which basically the critical current changes by some change in area for that trap divided by the area of the junction times the critical current. You've got the spectral density and the current, and then there's a critical current squared. So basically you get this equation here where the spectral density squared goes as the number of traps or the trap density times the change in area per fluctuator squared, the critical current squared over area. And so by doing this, what we can do is we can compare different junctions with different areas and different critical currents and figure out what the density of fluctuators and the area size, the product is. And he did this for the existing work at the time and found that for many different kinds of critical currents and areas, the spectral densities of the current noise was measured, and they found that with this kind of scaling relation that these all kind of came around to be a similar value. Not perfect, because you don't know if the density of defects is going to be the same for all of these different processes, but these are for different kinds of junctions made with different elements. And so then they get this 12 with these complicated units over here as kind of a parameter of the average quality of a junction at that time. And then Wellstead's work, which measures the temperature dependence in the 6 junctions, gets a parameter of 26. Oh, the idea from Van Harlingen's work is that this the coherence time or the dephasing time would be related to the square root of that s to the half. S to the half. Okay, and then Lukens has a paper. It's called something like How to Make a Qubit in 2 Days. And they have very, very good quality junctions there. Yeah. No, we don't know. This is all we can work with right now, right? So I think right now there's questions on, first of all, is this noise temperature dependent? Does it go as T squared? Like right now, look, Dutta Horn says T. Van Harlingen says T independent. Wellsted says T squared. We really don't know. Right now it's coming at the level of trying to characterize different junctions and seeing whether a model like this will kind of make things scale properly. Okay. So yeah, this is really at a rough level right now. It's hard because we have to measure the noise of a single Josephson junction. And it's not easy, and it's not easy at all. Okay, so here's our measurement. What we wanted to do is see whether the noise from the shunt resistor was spoiling everything. Because you need the shunt resistor to make the noise measurement. We want to find out whether that's an important aspect, the noise and the dissipation. So what we're doing is we set up a way where we can measure the junction in a non-zero mode, which is the traditional way that Wellsted did it, and then also in a zero voltage mode, which would be new. Oh, and by the way, Van Harlingen measured his without a squid, but they used a room temperature amplifier, and that could mean that it either could have produced back action or noise, or because of the lack of sensitivity, they might have had to work with a very high current, which could have produced a lot of self-heating, and that could have been why they didn't have temperature dependence. Okay, so we're doing the Wellsted style of measurement, where what you do is you have, we took a squid here, and then what we do is, if you bias it, it'll have a finite voltage, and so it has a dynamic resistance, okay? And so then what happens is if you have a 2-ohm resistor, and this dynamic resistance, which could be on the order of, let's say, 20 ohms, then what'll happen is this is a current divider. And so then the current will flow through this inductor that the squid reads out. Okay? And so now what happens is if the critical current here fluctuates, this current divider, if this goes down, then the current here is going to have to go up. Okay? Because you're injecting a certain current here, it's just going to, that fluctuation will be equal to that fluctuation as long as that dynamic resistance is large relative to 2 ohms. And we just choose that to be the case. Okay? And so then what we can do then is read out the current with a squid and send that to a spectrum analyzer, Fourier transform it, and see the 1 over F noise. We can turn off this current, and then what we can do is just see what the background noise is and get a background measurement. This is a picture of one of our units here. We have a squid, and then that's this squid here, and then it's reading out 3 different squids over here. What we're doing is we put them all in series, and we have different current leads, so we can voltage bias each one of these independently and then send the signal to the squid. So we can do 3 different junctions, one after the other in a cool down. Okay. This is our cell. And so we have to be very sensitive with RF noise and magnetic noise. So we have new metal shields, we have niobium shields, and we have to lead plate all of this. This isn't lead plated right now, but the Nyquist noise from the copper would wash out the noise that we're trying to study. And so this would be a nice 1 over F noise where you can see a nice proper, without no fluctuators, and then it's turning into white noise. And then what's happening here is this is when we're biasing the junction, and so we can see the 1 over F noise from the critical current fluctuation. And when we turn off the current, this acts as a superconductor, and now all we're doing is looking at the white noise coming off the 2-ohm resistor. And the neat thing here is to see that when we bias the junction, this dynamic resistance might go up to 20 ohms, but it's not noisy at high frequencies. So the noise over here is actually the Nyquist noise from the 2-ohm resistor, but it's being converted to a low current because of this clean resistor over here. And so then we see that the noise actually goes down when we're biasing the junction. Okay. So then we did some current bias reversal. It's a trick I can talk about later. Basically, there's a trick where you can invert the current, produce a phase shift in the flux you're applying on the squid, and see whether it's due to critical currents flux, or is it due to critical current fluctuations. And what it does is it'll get rid of signals that are due to critical current fluctuations. And what we see here is with bias reversal, let me see, without bias reversal, basically we found out that it was not due to flux. Okay. So now what we did was we set up the same system. There's really 2 junctions there, but we're using it as an RF squid now. And what we do is we can now, from the Josephson relations, what happens, how much time do I have left? Okay, I better cruise here. Okay, so then what happens is you've got an inductance over here from the Josephson relations. So what happens is if the current running through the junction changes, then the effective inductance of that loop changes. What we do is we couple that to a tank circuit. Now what happens is if the critical current here changes, inductance changes, what happens is it changes the resonant frequency of the tank circuit. We then run this off resonance and we look at the signal, and if the critical current changes here, we'll see a change in the voltage across the tank circuit. So we've got a FET amplifier here. We cool this down and we put the Josephson junction running as RF squid. What happens is we set this up in a dispersive mode. Usually an RF squid, you want the beta parameter, which makes this hysteretic, so that you get a dissipation depending on how much flux is in here. But we're running in a way which would be a very bad RF squid. What happens is it never becomes hysteretic. You never get dissipation. So magnetic field doesn't change the Q of that resonance. But instead what happens is if the critical current here changes, it changes the resonant frequency, and then we can see that. And so then we do a measurement of that at 4 Kelvin, and we can see for this RF method on that same device that the noise levels matched up. Okay, and then when we cooled it to 1.6 Kelvin, we see that there was a temperature dependence. So with this, it looks like it's T squared. Okay, but that's rough. It's only from 4.2 to 1.6 Kelvin. Okay, the nice thing about this measurement is that we have now set up a measurement that doesn't have any dissipation, so we can go and do very low temperature measurements without worrying about heating. Unfortunately, it would have also been nice if we found out that the shunt resistor was causing all the 1 over F noise and that this would have had nothing, but unfortunately that's not the case, and so we have the same level of noise whether we measure with the DC method or the zero voltage method or the non-zero method. Okay, another result. What we're doing here is we wanted to study many junctions just at 4 Kelvin and see whether we can change the properties of the 1 over F noise. So we did was we took the same junction and we annealed it at 150 degrees C for just a couple of hours, and we could see we could lower the critical current of the device. This is a subtract zero here, and so this is the critical current changing with annealing time, and then we measure the noise and we can see that we're changing the noise level of the 1 over F noise. It's rough, but this is what we have at the moment, and it's basically, I would say, a surprise that at 150 degrees you can change the 1 over F noise. And so this kind of gives you maybe an indication of where it could be from. You know, 150 degrees is not very hot. It could be in the aluminum, because you have aluminum oxide. There's this aluminum, and I would say there could be defects right on the interface. The other reason is because if you're low temperature annealing is going to be ineffective for bulk material, but on surfaces you can have a lot of diffusion. And so maybe something at an interface between, let's say, the niobium, aluminum oxide, somewhere like that, we're moving around defects at these temperatures and lowering the density of fluctuators. And so this is the distribution of 1 over F noise that we measured. And so Van Harlingen had this parameter 12, Welsit had 26, Lukens had this 1.5. We've got things like 11, 18, 4, 0.5, 0.6, and our best one is 0.3, and after annealing, 0.2. I'm losing my voice. But the next thing to do is measure the temperature dependence. So what we did was we set up filters, copper powder filters, and to attenuate the high frequencies so that we wouldn't get noise from the room. So this is the temperature dependence. You can see it dropping, and that's the background noise from 1.2 Kelvin to 20 milli K. And when we plot it, and we just took this last week, just got it working, we can see a linear temperature dependence from 1 Kelvin to 0.2, and then it flattens out. And so that's either due to heating or due to noise. And so this would agree with Dutta and Horn. It doesn't agree with Wellstood, but Wellstood did it on squids, and it doesn't agree with Crane, but he didn't use an amplifier, a squid. Get some water. You can read these. Thanks. Let's see if that worked. Okay. Yeah. So, basically, we measured like I said, the zero voltage method, we came up with that, and it looks like it agrees with the non-zero voltage measurement method, at least at 4.2 Kelvin. It might be that when we get colder, there will be a difference, because maybe the dissipation and the noise levels at 4.2 Kelvin are different than at 20 milli K. And the annealing is saying that it is some kind of a material effect. It's aluminum oxide has a very high temperature of melting, so I don't think we'd be changing the aluminum oxide itself, but maybe some interface between aluminum and aluminum oxide, because the critical current is also changing. It makes you realize that you are changing the junction at that point. And then we measure the temperature dependence, and we see a linear temperature dependence at the moment. There's a preliminary result, I'm pretty confident that it's right. And what we have to do is see if it's self-heating at the lower temperatures. And so what we can do, a nice trick that Wellstead came up with, is what you can do is deposit cooling fins on the shunt resistor, and it reduces the amount of heating. Because the heating comes in the shunt resistor, you need a certain resistance, 8 ohms or so, but what you can do is add something that looks kind of like a ping pong paddle, and what happens is you get the resistive contribution from that path, but you get the cooling effect of all of this volume over here. And so what we can do is deposit a cooling fin on top of our shunt resistor on the same junction and cool it down again, and then see if we end up reducing the extending the low temperature dependence to 20 milli K or so. Okay, thanks.